I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. John Waters is a filmmaker, journalist, writer, and stand-up comedian whose work spans almost five decades and ranges from cult classic movies all the way to Broadway. He's visiting Central Florida to kick off Pride Week, and I'll talk to him about his career as a filmmaker and storyteller. Also, author Karen Russell is one of this year's recipients of a MacArthur Genius Grant. I'll revisit a conversation we had earlier this year about how film influences her writing. That's ahead on Intersection. Joining me now is John Waters. John is a filmmaker, writer, journalist, actor, and stand-up comedian. He made his mark with cult movies, but he's perhaps best known for his 1988 film Hairspray. He's coming to Central Florida this week to kick off Orlando Pride Week. John, thank you very much for joining me.
Sure, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, let me ask you, just thinking back to your early career, what inspired you to become a filmmaker?
Well, I wanted to get out of Lutherville, Maryland. You know, I had a successful film career when I was very young. I mean, I made my first movie 50 years ago almost. But before that, I was a puppeteer for children's birthday parties. And the parents stopped hiring me when I put fake blood in it. And then I was a counselor at camp, or, you know, a young work boy counselor, where I would tell the campers every campfire that I'd read this story that I wrote, this horror story. And then the last day was going to be the ending. And they all freaked out. The parents called the camp. I got in trouble. So I started early, and I'm still doing the same thing. I have the same job as I had since I'm 12, which is to startle people and pull the rug out from under them and hopefully make them laugh.
Is it difficult to translate that kind of theatricality that you might get with running a puppet show or live theater into film?
Not really. Do you know how many film directors were puppeteers first? It's scary. And David Lockery, who was an actor in a lot of my early films, used to say to me, "You're not my puppet, you know." Well, you are a little bit. If you're the director in a film, today actors like to improvise. I'm not big on improvising. I'm a member of the Writers Guild. I think if you like the script, you should say it as written.
You've had your hand in all aspects, so to speak, of filmmaking, writing and directing. Where do you get the ideas from your stories?
Well, I was more than just the writer or the director. In the earliest films, I was the cameraman, the editor, the person that told you there is no food. I was the teamster. I picked you up in the car in the morning in my mother's station wagon. I get the ideas because it's my job. I never have a problem getting ideas. I jump out of bed every morning. And to this day, I have pads in every room of my house, in my car, everywhere for any idea I get. And I have different folders that I stuff in. Is this going to be a movie? Is this going to be a novel? Is this going to be an art piece? Is this going to be a stand-up thing? So I'm inspired to just watch normal people act the way they do every day. I don't understand why people watch reality TV, because to me, that's feeling superior to the people that you're watching and you make fun of them. But actually, they're getting paid and you're wasting your time. So who's the dumb one?
Mm-hmm. And just your comment now about being involved in every single aspect of the filmmaking process, do you get the sense?
Well, I used to. I didn't at the end. Certainly, it is a collaborative effort. But in the beginning, I didn't have the money to collaborate with anybody, and I just kind of had to learn how to do it myself. The same way today. Every kid's making a film on a cell phone. It's the same thing with their friends. That's the same thing I did.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you would have made the same start and maybe chosen film as a medium if you were starting out your career now?
Probably, yes. I think I probably would have if I had started, or I was always a writer. That's the thing I've done the most consistently, because I wrote every movie I made. I never made a movie that someone else thought up. So every project that I do, I write. At my stand-up show, I write. Even when I do the artwork, it's conceptual art. I think it up before I do it. I basically write it, too. So I think I'm a writer, mostly. That would probably be the thing that I do consistently on every project.
Let me ask you this. I mean, back in 1964, I believe, when you started out in your film career, those movies were considered cult classics.
No, wait, let me stop you there. That's very kind of you to say that. They weren't considered anything. The first movie I made was Hag in a Black Leather Jacket. It was 8mm. It was shown once in a beatnik coffee house on Howard Street in Baltimore to absolutely no notice.
Mm-hmm.
So calling it a classic, that's very sweet of you. I guess the first movie, The Pink Flamingos, I'll say that. That's a midnight movie classic. It is. I'm very proud of it. It hasn't gotten nicer. I go to colleges today, and it gets the same reaction from a 17-year-old kid seeing it for the first time. And I say 17 because you're supposed to be 18. Mm-hmm. Every 17-year-old has the same reaction when they see it as they did when it first came out in 1972.
Is that gratifying to see that your work still carries the same weight that it did back then?
Sure. The most gratifying thing to me is I get older and my audience gets younger. It's the only thing you can't buy is a young audience. And when I go to the schools all the time, which I do really a lot, it's amazing to me. I see kids with tattoos of the names of my movies. One girl had a page of the script of Female Trouble tattooed on her leg.
What do you say to somebody like that? Is that like the kind of uber fan that you'd like to run away from? Or do you just sit down and have a conversation with them?
I say thank you. They bought me my dinner last night. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't understand people that are rude to fans because they're like your customers. I mean, without them, I wouldn't be. I live in three homes. They bought me everything. Liberace used to say this. You like this outfit? You should. You bought it for me. Mm-hmm. And it's true. People say I hate to interrupt, but they are. But still, I do every cell phone picture and everything because those are the people that made you who you are. Those are the people that enabled you to never have to get a real job.
Were you creating those films back in the 60s? Were you creating with a specific audience in mind, or were you just putting them out there to see what reaction they got from anybody?
I think I did have a specific audience in mind. These were movies made at the height of the hippie period, even though we were more yippies and they were more punk rock movies, but there was no such word for that yet. So I think I made movies for people that couldn't even fit in their own minorities, black people that couldn't get along with other black people, gay people that couldn't get along with other gay people, hippies that couldn't get along with other hippies, the people that were rejected from the minorities themselves. The first audiences for Pink Flamingos was some gay people, but most people presume it was predominantly gay. It was bikers. It was just people that were dissatisfied, angry, and had a sense of humor.
Do you feel like there's more out there now? There's a broader range of entertainment available for different groups of different people?
Well, I think what originally I did was sort of I made exploitation films for art movies, and I think now, really, bad taste is American humor. That's what Hollywood sells now. I don't anymore. I don't think Pecker was really a bad taste movie. But at the same time, Hollywood does sell that now. And when they think of an American comedy in the rest of the world, they think Gross Out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think Hollywood tries too hard these days. Because it's about wit. It's not just about Gross Out. If you can surprise somebody, you make them look at something in a different way, and you can change them. But it's simple to be disgusting. It's much harder to be funny and transgressive.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always succeed either. Sometimes I'm just disgusting.
If you're talking about Hollywood sort of jumping on that disgusting Gross Out bandwagon, when do you think that really started?
Probably it started with Porky's would be the first one, maybe. And then certainly it went from there. I think The Hangover, a movie I like very much, and Bridesmaids turned it into an entire different genre with many bad imitations.
Well, let me ask you this, too. In early films, you put your characters in pretty outlandish situations. You talked about Pink Flamingos, for example. And you said that your inspiration, you think these things up, but you get the ideas from just observing folks as well. Is that where the inspiration came from for some of the scenes in that movie?
Well, it certainly came from that movie was made in 1971. It came out in 72, but it didn't really come out in the rest of the country till 73 and 4. It was the year Deep Throat became legal. It was when pornography became illegal. Everything changed. I grew up on exploitation movies. I would go but I would watch Bergman movies because he always had vomit scenes in them. The foreign films broke the taboo laws. But I would also see nudist camp movies. I would see gore movies. And I put all these together to try to make a weird art movie that was a genre film like no other genre. So the movies are something that really influenced me then. But what was left that you couldn't do? It was not illegal to eat dog do, but who would do it? Now, today, it is illegal in porn, but who would do it is Johnny Knoxville, mm-hmm. A comedian I like very, very much, who I think is a great actor.
Is there any territory now that you think that is left to transgress on?
I always say, I say to every film class I've ever taught in my life, if you really want to be transgressive, make a movie that's rated NC-17 and has no sex or violence in it. I don't know how to do that, but that would be an amazing movie that would scare people that much that didn't have sex or violence. You would be on to something, that would be the next fad that would change the world.
Is that something you've got in the back of your mind? Are you planning to make that movie at some point?
No, I think that's up to youth. I think that's up to the next 20-year-old crazy kid somewhere in America who's listening to this show that's making a film with his crazy friends on the cell phone tonight and is going to go do it this weekend.
Johnny Knoxville, do you see him as a genuinely talented actor aside from the shock value of the movies that he's been in?
Well, he was the star of my last movie, A Dirty Shame, and I thought he was quite good in it playing a sex addict. Yes, I think Johnny is a very good actor. He's done a lot of acting roles. I think he is also a very good comedian, and I think he is amazing to me because those Jackass movies were movies that were giant hits, and I would see them, and it was always blue-collar dads and their fathers watching male nudity together and loving it. It was so bizarre. It was anarchy in a way that how he could ever get away with that, and that's why it was so original.
Do you think he's gotten his due as an actor from the general public?
Well, I think he's gotten his due as a creator of this incredible series. He has a new movie coming out where he plays the world's oldest man, and I've seen trailers for it. It's hilarious. It's like candid camera. So I think Johnny, he's a friend of mine, and I think he is certainly not feeling neglected and is a very humble guy in real life and a very, very funny guy. And so, yes, maybe he hasn't gotten quite as much praise as he should as an actor, but when you are a comedian and an actor, you don't usually get praise. Not that many people win Oscars for being funny.
I'm speaking with John Waters. He's a filmmaker, writer, journalist, actor, and stand-up comedian, best known for his 1988 film Hairspray. He's in Central Florida to kick off Orlando Pride Week. You can join the conversation online on Facebook or Twitter. You can also send us an email at intersection@wmfe.org. Well, let me just come back to that idea you were talking about before. When you show that movie, Pink Flamingos, you say you still get the same reaction when you show that movie. But do you think it's getting harder to shock people these days in America and, you know, 2015?
It's getting harder to shock and be funny and to change anything. It's always easy to shock. I never just tried to shock. I tried to startle you. I started to surprise you, to make you consider something in a different way once you looked at it, and to not judge other people because you don't know what causes people's behavior. And people can be neurotic and happy. They don't have to be like you. They don't have to believe in mental health that you may believe in. So I think that has been my politics, but I think I've been understood, God knows. I think I've had a very long career that I don't feel like I have been neglected or misunderstood by the public.
Well, what about there seems to have been a bit of a shift in some ways from new and exciting things being done in film to that kind of new territory being broken in television, cable TV. Do you get the sense that there is there are more interesting things happening in television now than film, or do you think film is still...
I do. I think you're right. I think that there is better things on television than independent films today. I hate to say that, but there is.
Could you name a few?
No, because I'm not a person that's a snob about television. I think The Wire, Pee Wee Herman, and Howdy Doody are the only television shows I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. But I don't watch TV now. And I know there's good stuff on. There's really good stuff on. But I like to read, and I read every night, and I have to choose one of the two. I can't read 5 books a week or 4 books a week and binge watch television series. I'm not saying I'm better or smarter or anything. It's just how I relax. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time turning on the TV. It's so complicated now. You have to use so many different remotes, and I get confused. A book, I just pick it up and read it.
So you don't have your e-reader there while you're watching something on TV?
Any TV show that you can read while you watch it is a bad TV show. You never could read while you watch The Wire. You had to pay attention. Mm-hmm. You're talking about static background noise. That I can't stand. Like when you walk in your house and just turn on the TV. That is something I have never done in my whole life. If anyone has it on, I walk in and turn it off. If I want to watch something, yes, I sit down and I plan to watch it. Or I stream it or all that. But to just have it on is a piece of furniture that attacks me.
Well, let me take you back, if I may, to 1988, the movie Hairspray. A little different, I suppose, a bit of a departure from some of the earlier works you are known for. Did you set out to write that movie with a broader audience in mind, or did it just fall that way?
Well, I think after Desperate Living, which was the last of my Midnight Movies, video came out. So the entire game changed. Nobody went to Midnight Movies. They had their own Midnight Movies at home. So I had made Before Polyester, which was the first R-rated movie, and it was in Odorama, and it played fairly widely for certainly a John Waters movie. But no, when I sat down to write Hairspray, I didn't think this one's going to be commercial, this one's going to be a Broadway musical or anything. But I knew that it was a much bigger budget than I had ever had. I was shocked when it got a PG-13 rating. No, it got just PG, not even PG-13. And it was a hit. It got very good reviews, but Divine died a week after it came out. So it was not that big a financial hit, because the worst thing you can ever have for a comedy is the star to die tragically the week it comes out. That's really not funny. Mm-hmm. When it became a Broadway musical, I saw from the very first time I saw a reading of it, I knew that it would be a hit, but I never said it out loud because I was so afraid to curse it. Hairspray has been an amazing thing in my life. I have bought my apartment in San Francisco with the money from Hairspray. Believe me, it's the only thing I've ever done that made that kind of hit. I've been paid to write a sequel to the musical called White Lipstick with Hollywood money that never happened. I was paid to write a Hollywood TV series with a pilot and the Bible for it, which never happened. So Hairspray's been the gift that keeps on giving, and I'll never rest in peace till it becomes a Holiday on Ice, Hairspray on Ice. That's what I'm looking for. And I made that joke on a talk show, and I got actual phone calls the next day from ice companies seriously considering it.
Did you get people who'd watched Hairspray, maybe that was the first John Waters movie they'd seen, and then that was their introduction to your work, yeah, and then going to other works and being completely surprised or baffled?
Yes, that did happen. I mean, my parents finally could say, oh, we liked it without their nose growing. But yes, people would do it, and they'd go in a video shop and say, let's get another John Waters movie. And they'd get Pink Flamingos. That doesn't sound shocking. It's a movie about the Everglades or something. And then watch it and really be horrified. Yes, that did happen. Not so much anymore, but because now they could watch later ones and be horrified. I mean, my first movies that went everywhere was Pink Flamingos, which caused lots of censorship troubles, and A Dirty Shame, my last movie, got an NC-17 rating. So I didn't go that far. I've made every kind of movie, an underground movie, a midnight movie, an independent movie, a Hollywood movie, and now a Hollywood independent, and now I think A Dirty Shame was a Hollywood underground movie. Mm-hmm. So I think I've covered the bases.
Would you like to write for TV as well?
Sure. I did the whole Hairspray thing, which I think would have been good. I'm not against. I have many ways to tell stories. I don't care in really how I do it, as long as I can tell them.
Mm-hmm. What about the difference between filmmaking, writing for film rather, and writing for the printed page? What do you prefer, writing books or movies?
Well, and some recently, I prefer writing the printed page because it's just myself. You know, I have a new book coming out next summer called Carsick, and I hitchhiked across America by myself last May, from the front door of my Baltimore house to my apartment in San Francisco. And it was quite an adventure. And the book I wrote before that, Role Models, was a bestseller. So it did great. So I'm liking writing books. I've written two ones a long time ago called Shock Value and Crackpot. They've never gone out of print since 1980, the first one. So I've had good run with books.
Were you worried at any time hitchhiking across the States? It's not something a lot of people do these days.
You should, actually. I was worried. Now that it's over, it's hard to imagine worrying. But when I stood there for 10 hours with nobody picking up, I worried it was going to take 2 years to get there. Mm-hmm. But it took really only 11 days.
Did people know who you were when you got into the cab?
Some did, but they drove past me. And thought, well, why would that be him on an entrance ramp in Kansas? And they'd come back. Most people thought I was homeless.
Right.
And technically, I sort of was. I almost had to spend the night in the woods one night.
What was the most exciting experience you had on that road trip?
You're going to have to read the book for that one. That's the book tour. I'm not going to give away the whole story. And this is part fiction, too. The first part of the book, I wrote a novel where I imagined the 15 best rides with sex and adventure. And then I wrote the 15 worst rides I could ever imagine, which ending in my death. And I wrote my death the day before I went and did it for real, mm-hmm, which was 21 rides. And it's a optimistic book. The people that picked me up were great.
Well, let me talk a little bit about the event you're at in Orlando. You're in town to kick off Pride Week, and you have been honored in the past with awards to recognize your contribution to LGBT film and media. And you've also been quoted as saying you like to poke fun at gay rules as much as straight ones.
I do. Yeah, they're getting really a lot of rules these days. There's so many letters. Uh-huh. You know, why do we have to be good all the time? I think lesbians have the right to be bad mothers, too.
Is that what people can expect from your show, some poking fun
at
some of those
rules? A little bit of it, yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm a gay man who chooses not to be married. So is there a new bad word for me? But of course, I campaigned with Governor O'Malley in Maryland for gay marriage, and we won, and to stop the death penalty, too, which we won.
Mm-hmm. And of course, things do seem to be changing. Of course, we saw that landmark decision from the Supreme Court repealing the Defense of Marriage Act over the summer. Do you think we are moving in the right direction for supporting gay rights?
Of course we are. Of course we are. I never understood why anybody would be threatened by somebody getting married. Even if I married a tree, it's really hard to find somebody to love, no matter if you're straight, gay, whatever you are. Why would that threaten anybody? It's amazing to me why anybody would be upset about gay marriage or gay adoption. What, a child is better in an orphanage? I don't understand that.
What else needs to be done, do you think, to promote equality?
Well, that's a tough thing. That is a very, very complicated issue, equality. I think we're coming in the right direction, but it's confusing. It's a classist thing. In rich white schools, it's cool to be gay. It's better to be gay. At NYU, they say gay by May. But in a ghetto school, it's still you can get hassled a lot for it. It's in poorer neighborhoods, it's not cool. So it's is it a classist thing to be gay? When did that happen?
What about Florida, too? I mean, it's often seen as quite a conservative state. Does that seem kind of accurate? Do you feel like there's
yes.
a good audience for your...
Well, I'm waiting for you to prove me otherwise. But sometimes you can have the most fun in repression. I remember the years when the people I hated the most were president. Demonstrating was fun, too. I think you can have fun with being bad under when you're repressed a little bit, when there's something to fight against. Too much acceptance can be equally troubling.
Mm-hmm. Is there a good audience? Do you get sort of good reception from folks down in Florida when you come to do a performance or for your movies?
Yes, I come to Florida a lot, it seems. Yes, I do. They're really friendly audiences. They're really good. And maybe that's something to do with it. I don't know. But people generally, if I come, the people that hate me don't come and say, oh, I hate you to raise the first question. We hate you. That doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of people that do, but they just don't bother to come. If people come to see me, I think they have some idea what they're going to get. But today, parents bring their troubled children to see me, which I find touching. And when I started, parents called the police when they knew their children had my films. Today, they bring their children with me as a last-ditch effort to bond, which I find touching.
That's kind of a responsibility. Do you feel the weight of that?
Well, I'm good with them, and I talk to them, and I always like, you know, sometimes like really scary drag queens and their whole face is pierced with tattoos. I say, have you talked to your parents recently? And they look really horrified that I say that. But I think people are learning, parents are learning, kids are learning that it's tough, but you reach a truce and you watch what you say, and that's mental health. You know you can get on their nerves, they can get on your nerves, and you decide not to do it, and you speak before you say everything, and maybe that's mental health.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking with John Waters. John is a filmmaker, writer, journalist, actor, stand-up comedian. He's best known for his 1988 film Hairspray. He's in Central Florida this week to kick off Orlando Pride Week. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me. If you're there, say hi.
Up next, a conversation with Florida author and recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant, Karen Russell. Florida-born author Karen Russell was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction with her novel Swamplandia. She was recently awarded a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. I spoke with Karen earlier this year on Intersection about her latest work of fiction, the short story collection Vampires in the Lemon Grove. In that conversation, she talked about the art of writing horror stories and how film influences her work. Reading this book of stories, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, I'm really struck by the cinematic nature of some of the imagery. I mean, the very vivid stories and the imagery you bring across is that they conjure up some pretty startling pictures in your mind. Are you a big fan of film and horror films in particular?
Yeah, I love horror films. I really do. And thank you. I'm glad to hear that. I think I tend to be sort of a visual writer. There are others, you know, Old Marcel, he's olfactory. You know, there are other writers I think rely on different senses, or some are more cerebral, abstract. But I'll get pictures first, often, pictures of landscapes or images or whatever. And my brother and I, my sister, I don't know what particular deficiency that's filling, but we loved horror movies. You know, they were just vitamins to us. And whenever I go visit my brother now as adults, we just saw one called Triangle that I recommend to everybody. pure dread. A ghost ship shows up. These people are stranded at sea and a completely empty ship in the Bermuda Triangle. So I'm always jealous of the immediate suspense, you know, that just that gut drop of dread that you can feel in a horror movie. Some of my favorite fiction does that trick too.
Do you think it's harder though to create that sense of urgent dread that you get in a horror movie with a book?
I mean, I think horror movies get some significant assists from music, right? I wish there was a way to score your story so you could have some, you know, isn't that amazing? If you've got the right score, it doesn't matter what the camera is focused on. If you have the right kind of like violin screech, like a blade of grass is suddenly terrifying. So I do think that there's a way... language can do it too, right? But it's more participatory, and I think maybe it requires a little a collaboration with the reader, certainly. And I think film, there's something about the visual immediacy of it where it just gets you in a primal place.
What were some of your favorite horror films when you were growing up?
Oh my gosh. Anything based on a Stephen King novel I really liked.
And is he a writer you liked reading as well, or you still like reading?
I love reading him. I think he's getting better and better. He had a story collection, at least, Full Dark No Stars, that I thought really exquisite. And I haven't done his time travel JFK novel yet, but I'm excited to. And I do think it's funny to think that this one human being was so kind of prolifically dark that he haunted millions of people. I mean, there's something to me, too, about the idea that he's a bestseller. I find his stuff incomparably strange, truly frightening, you know? And the idea that so many people hearken to that weird tune, there's something kind of, I don't know what the right word is, certainly not reassuring. But it makes me feel less lonely anyways, because it's sort of it's a signal that even everybody's sweet librarians wearing a Gap vest reading Stephen King, you know, there's some acknowledgement that there is this darker side to things. Or whatever.
When you write some of these stories, do you have a goal at some point of saying, I'm going to try and scare the reader as much as possible, or are you trying to scare yourself?
Well, I hope to. You know, with these stories in particular, often there's just to inject some humility or levity, and I would try to have some comedy in there too, right? Because I think that they're kind of two sides of the same coin. If you just go for complete darkness and exclusive tragedy, there's this way that it's going to feel sentimental and false, you know, and I think the best jokes kind of grow out of this sense of the deep, funny strangeness of things, is how a professor of mine put it once, which I liked a lot. But I think it is good to scare yourself as you're writing. I think it always feels like maybe I'm on the right track if I myself feel exposed or uncomfortable. With the Reeling for the Empire story, some parts of that were quite unsettling and sort of grotesque and really visceral. And unpleasant. I guess the word is unpleasant. And I thought that wasn't a bad thing to be feeling that as I was writing it.
And the story Proving Up, I guess the basic outline is that it's a young boy or a young man out on a quest for his family. And there are some really spooky elements. And, you know, part of what makes this story so frightening, I think, is by the end of it, you're not quite sure what's happened. Do you think there needs to be an element of suspense going beyond the end of the story for a horror story to really grab you?
I do. I really do. I really think... And those tend to be my favorite endings in fiction and film, where there's a kind of terrifying, unsettled quality. I mean, a real kind of uncanny hesitation between different possibilities. That always feels like the truest ending to me in a way, because what endings do you ever get in this life anyhow, right? I mean, you don't want to put a nail through the coffin so the reader can take a breath. I think you want the haunting to continue inside the body of the reader, if a story is going to work at all.
That was author Karen Russell. You can listen to the entire interview on our website at wmfe.org/intersection. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.